Remember those baptismal certificates that hung on your grandparents' wall? Beautiful. They had the baptism of Jesus and other images and their name. It was always a constant reminder of the gift that the Lord Jesus gave them in their baptism. Well, we have a new version of that. If you visit wolfsoncreative.com, you can see the baptismal certificates there. They're available electronically for congregations to print as many as you want, or individually, paper copies for families to hang on the wall and treasure the Lord's gift of baptism. The website is wolfsoncreative.com. And with each purchase, Issues Etc. gets a portion of the proceeds to carry on their work. Thanks for visiting wolfsoncreative.com.
But as I've said before, and I repeat it to President Hu, we have some core views as Americans about the universality of certain rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion.
The terminology that I used, I believe, seemed to disenfranchise other religions, and it certainly was not meant to do that.
Neither side, whether political left or political right, should claim Jesus as he's our mascot.
Luther is offering us a conservative reformation to not throw out things that the Roman Church does just because they do it. That's an overreaction.
Southern Illinois truck drivers who love Issues, etc.
Well, in the Old Testament, there's few others who garner as much attention and as much ink as David. His name is synonymous with the kingship, with the high point in Israel's religious history. Although, if you look at David's life, it's not such a high point. There are no plaster saints there in the Old Testament. And there are some apparent contradictions that people have noticed in the various accounts of David's life, especially his children and his grandchildren. We continue our series on apparent contradictions in the Bible on this Thursday afternoon, January the 20th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. This is Issues Etc. You can join us for the next hour, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. In a half hour, we'll be talking with Molly Hemingway of Christianity Today and Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service, both of them of GetReligion.org, about media coverage of religion. 1-877-623-6943. Talk back at IssuesETC.org. Send us a tweet at IssuesETC. Joining us to continue our series on apparent contradictions in the Bible, focus a little bit on David, his children, and his grandchildren, Dr. Andrew Steinman. He's professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, and he's author of the Concordia Commentaries on Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, and Proverbs, a very busy, busy writer. Dr. Steinman, welcome back.
Nice to be back with you, Todd.
Let's start with Solomon here, and we're just dealing with two accounts, kind of the mundane, here are the children of sons of David, and David apparently had quite a number of wives, and therefore lots and lots of children and grandchildren. The short one is in 2 Samuel 12, which appears to list Solomon as the kind of the only son of David and Bathsheba. And then there's one, and that would probably, if we read that account, that would make Solomon second son of David and Bathsheba, because the first one dies as judgment from God over their adulteries.
Mm-hmm.
The other account in 1 Chronicles 3 has Solomon listed as, I believe, number five out of five kids, the fifth. Is there a contradiction here?
I don't think so. I don't think that we can say that, for instance, that Chronicles is listing them in birth order. There's good evidence at times that Chronicles doesn't list everybody in birth order. One of those sons that's listed before Solomon might be the son that died shortly after it was born because of God's judgment on David's adultery with Bathsheba. It may be that Solomon is listed last in that list, not because he was the fifth son, but actually to emphasize him, because the places that get emphasis are either the first and the last or in the list. And it may be that they save Solomon for the last person, the fifth son in the list, so that when you hit the end of the sons of Solomon, you stop with the most important one, or sons of, excuse me, David, you stop with the most important one, and that's Solomon. So just because they're in a certain order in Chronicles does not mean that that's their birth order. I think probably the correct way to understand this is that Solomon is the second-born son for David and Bathsheba, but that he's listed fifth probably for emphasis in Chronicles.
Now, this the comparison of these two accounts, especially this the First Chronicles 3 account of David's descendants, raises an attendant question that I'm sure you get a lot, and that is, David had a lot of wives and concubines.
Yes, he did. David acted just like a king in his day. I mean, like many of the kings of the nations. And, of course, you know, Samuel had warned the people before they had a king, when they requested a king. When you get a king, these are some of the things he's going to do. And one of the things he's going to do is he's going to have these wives, you know. This was common in the ancient Near East, and David is a child of his times. We may like to think of him as holy and pure and stuff like that, but we know he wasn't because of his adultery with Bathsheba. Well, another way that he was like the kings around him was that he took many wives. Some of these were probably for political reasons, either important people in Israel with whom he wanted to be aligned, or occasionally important people from the nations around him whom he came to dominate. The fact that David did this simply is a fact that we need to realize, that David was not perfect. The Bible does not portray him as perfect, and this is another example of that.
Okay, having kind of set that one aside, let's deal with some more questions of his progeny. Here's an apparent contradiction some have found. In 2 Samuel 6:23, it says, "Therefore, Michal," that would be the daughter of Saul who had married David, kind of I guess you could call her kind of the legitimate royal heir on the female side, "had no children to the day of her death." Then, later in the same book, chapter 21, verse 8, it says, "So the king took Armoni and Nephi-Bosheth, the two sons of Rizpah and the daughters of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul, and the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of," and then the names don't matter anymore.
Right.
She's listed, or someone by the same name, is listed as having five sons, whereas we're told that as part of David's displeasure, she was left childless.
Yeah, that's a good question. Notice that it's the daughter of Saul whom she bore to Adriel, son of Barzillai, not whom she bore to David. You'll remember there's, probably most of your readers won't, but I'm sure you do, remember that Saul gave his daughter away after David had to flee Saul's court when Saul was trying to kill him. He gave his daughter away. She was temporarily married to this other man, and then was brought back. David demanded that he get his wife back, and Michal was brought back. So I think that the statement that we have in Kings that she had no children, after that point when she mocked David for dancing in front of the ark. At that point, she had no more children. Apparently, had no children with David at any time. But it's entirely possible that she had children before that time when she had been married off a second time to this other man. And that would explain these other sons.
What would, just incidentally, what would it have meant for the king to keep one of his wives childless? What would it have meant in that culture?
Well, it would have meant very much that she was out of favor, that she that definitely... she was not going to be viewed as the queen. The queen was the favored wife. And, of course, the queen, it would be expected that the queen then would give birth to the heir to the throne. So it definitely means that she is no longer going to produce anybody from the line, kind of the line of Saul and David, right, because she's Saul's daughter, David's wife. It also means supreme humiliation for her because she's the first wife, and it's usually assumed that the first wife is going to be the favored wife.
Does it mean something also that it is not Saul's line in any sense whatsoever? I mean, Saul
right.
being the first king, not Saul's son, nor even his daughter by marriage to David, that carries on the royal line? Is there a greater statement being made there about God's displeasure with Michael's father?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Saul's line is removed completely. And so there's no chance whatsoever that you're even going to have kind of this line through his daughter. Definitely not any line through the sons, but there's no question that there's going to be any kind of bloodline from Saul among the kings that come from David.
And I guess kind of a attending Sunday school question there is, if God didn't want them to have a king in the first place, yet he permitted them to have Saul, why does he permit them to make such a, I guess in retrospect, such an abysmal choice for the king in the first place?
Yeah, that is a good question, and my students sometimes ask me that. First of all, we should realize that, you know, God did have a plan to have a king. I mean, it's prophesied early on that Israel's going to have a king. What God was displeased about was that the people asked for a king in the wrong way, at the wrong time, and with the wrong motive. I mean, God tells Samuel, you know, when Samuel's displeased by this request, Samuel, don't get upset. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me as king. And the problem was they wanted a king instead of God. Had they wanted a king for earthly purposes but still wanted to kind of acknowledge God's ultimate rule, that'd be a different thing. But God had made provisions for a king. It was just the wrong time, the wrong place, the wrong way to ask, and the wrong desire.
About 30 seconds here.
Yeah, and so the other part of your question then is, why does God allow it and give them Saul? I think the lesson here is God is giving him a king that they would have chosen first to show them how wrong they were before he gives them a man after his own heart, David.
All right, when we come back from this break, we'll continue our series with Dr. Andrew Steinman, Apparent Contradictions in the Bible, dealing with the children and grandchildren of David, and then exactly how many Syrians were slain by David. There is about a tenfold difference between two different accounts. We'll be right back.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a new charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Theology for blue collar, white collar, and clerical collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's a great resource for Sunday school teachers. Mondays, we interview Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House about the upcoming Growing in Christ Sunday School lesson. You'll find these interviews under the Listen on Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. Listen to a 20-minute interview with Pam Nielsen, and you'll be prepared to teach Sunday school this weekend. Issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand and look for Teaching a Sunday School Lesson with Deaconess Pam Nielsen.
The latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal is out. It contains an article that I've written titled The Theology of Jesus. What's the connection between the Church's Confession of Christ and her Confession of the Trinity? Find out with the latest Issues Etc. journal. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Mason Beecroft writes about the false promises of Pop American Christianity. Get your copy of the latest Issues Etc. journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Thursday, January the 20th. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. In about 10 minutes, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway of Christianity Today magazine will join us along with Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service. They are both of GetReligion.org. They deal with the media coverage of religion for the last 7 years on that very successful blog. We'll find out what they have learned in the last 7 years blogging there. Dr. Steinman, before we get into the question of Absalom and how many sons he had, set the stage for us, because Absalom is a tragic figure in David's life. He's a tragic figure in his own right. What's going on in this son of David?
Yeah, Absalom has a number of problems, I guess, with his father. Absalom's sister, Tamar, gets raped by her half-brother, and David does nothing about it. And this, of course, makes Absalom very upset and is eventually going to lead to Absalom's rebellion. He's going to kill his half-brother who raped his sister. He has to flee from David's court for a while. Then through Joab, the commander of David's army, David's cousin, he's brought back into Israel. At that point, Absalom starts to foment rebellion, and part of his complaint, I believe, is that David doesn't give justice, and he knows this firsthand because he saw how his sister didn't get justice. So Absalom ends up leading this rebellion against David, the rebellion, of course, is unsuccessful, and Joab ends up actually killing Absalom, despite the fact that David had ordered that Absalom not be killed. Joab does it anyway. And we have David's lament over Absalom recorded in the book of Samuel 2. So he's quite a tragic figure. He had, after his brother was killed, he figured as the oldest surviving son he had a right to the kingdom. And that might have also played into his rebellion at some point.
So the question rises over an apparent contradiction between 2 Samuel 14, 27, 2 Samuel 18, 18, where we're told that Absalom had three sons, and then later Absalom describes himself as having no son, what does he say here, no son to keep my name in remembrance.
Right.
Which is it?
Well, I think it's both. It's likely that Absalom's sons probably died early. In the ancient world, it's not uncommon for many, many children not to live to adulthood. If you made it to adulthood, you have a good chance of living, you know, to 40, 50, even 80 at times. My guess is that when he makes this statement, all of his sons probably had succumbed to disease or war or something, and had died, and so now he's setting up this monument in his remembrance because he has no sons to remember him. He has no sons to carry on his line, and I think this is probably an expression of his grief as much as anything else, in that all of his children have died probably early.
Is this more of the same as we saw with Saul than replaced by David? And David's line just doesn't go the way that one would think it's going to go. In fact, I mean, even today it would be scandalous for any royal line, let's say the British royal line, to be passed on through an illegitimate child of adultery. But it is.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, of course, a theme you get as far back as Genesis, that the oldest son of Abraham is not the child of the promise, not the son of Hagar. It's the child of Sarah, who she eventually has in her old age. With Jacob and Esau, it's not the older son, it's the younger son, confounding all expectations. With Jacob's sons, it's not any of the first three sons who get God's great blessing, but it's the fourth son, Judah, again, confounding all expectations. So it's often that God confounds the expectations that the world has, and through his grace chooses whom he wants. And in the case of Solomon, we see the same thing. It's none of the older sons, that are put on the throne, but it's the son that is born later and is born from an adulterous, what began as an adulterous relationship, at least.
Does it, in many ways, kind of tell us what's going to, what the rest of the David's line, and then eventually split into two, one legitimate, one less legitimate line, it's what it's going to be like for the kingship of Israel from this point on?
Yeah, it really does, and I think it has implications all the way down into the New Testament, because, of course, even when Jesus is born, to the world, he looks illegitimate, right? I mean, Mary is not married to Joseph when she becomes pregnant, and the world thinks, again, there's something wrong here, and even Joseph thought that at first. He was going to put her away until, of course, he's told otherwise by God's angel. And so you have this constant kind of God doing it his way, confounding expectations, splitting up the kingdom after Solomon fails, keeping only a part of the kingdom for David's line, but nevertheless remembering his promise to David. It just over and over again, you get the impression that it's not the way human beings would design it. It's always the way God would design it.
Let's turn to one other apparent contradiction with regard to David that doesn't have to do with his children, but with his conquests in battle. And, I mean, first, to set the groundwork, you got to deal with the fact that some of these numbers that are recounted for David and in the other battles as well are sometimes stretch credulity. They seem to be overblown numbers or exaggerated numbers. Liberal Bible scholars will routinely say it's just the way they wrote history. This exaggerated their numbers for propaganda's sake. What is your response to that?
Well, I don't think that the biblical writers exaggerated numbers for propaganda's sake. I do think that at times they used round numbers. I mean, they might use a number like 10,000. It doesn't mean exactly 10,000. It means roughly 10,000. There might have been 9,950 or 10,205 or something, but roughly 10,000. So I think we have to take the numbers as round numbers, but I think they are accurate as long as you understand that they're oftentimes not giving you exact figures, but, you know, what we would call ballpark figures.
Okay, here again, the apparent contradiction is between the 2 Samuel account of David's life and the Chronicles account of David's life. The first one says, and this is 2 Samuel 10, verse 18, "Then the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers, 40,000 horsemen of the Syrians, and struck Shobach, the commander of the army, who died there." That's the 2 Samuel account. Here's the 1 Chronicles account, obviously written later. "Then the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed 7,000 charioteers, 40,000 foot soldiers of the Syrians, and killed Shophach, the commander of the army." It reads almost exactly the same, except there's a tenfold difference between the number of charioteers that are apparently killed. How do we resolve this?
I think this is probably a problem of the transmission of the text. Keep in mind that although the original writers of the scriptures were inspired, and therefore the Holy Spirit guided them and kept them from error, that does not apply to the people who copied over the text. And numbers are some of the easiest things to miscopy. And I think probably what happened here was somebody dropped a zero, and it ended up, probably my guess is a mistake in the Samuel text that has come down to us, and probably the correct text in Chronicles, even though Chronicles was written later. There's good evidence, I think. Anybody that reads Chronicles sensitively realizes that the author of Chronicles, we'll call him the chronicler for better, that the chronicler had access to court records that had survived. And he's probably getting this either from the court records, or he probably had access to the book of Samuel, too, because sometimes he seems to reproduce things word for word out of Samuel. In this case, he may have had a better text of Samuel than we have, that we've got a text that unfortunately comes from an error and that somebody dropped the zero. Anybody who's worked with figures a long time, that doesn't surprise them that some copyist might drop a zero.
So with only 30 seconds here, you're actually saying that it's not the Chronicles that is an exaggeration of the Samuel account. It's the other way around. The Samuel account is probably underestimating the body count.
Yes, I think so. That would make sense. With 40,000 horsemen, I think you need 7,000 charioteers. 700 charioteers is way too few for 40,000 horsemen.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago. He's author of the Concordia Commentaries on Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Proverbs. Thank you very much for being our guest.
It's a pleasure, Todd.
Cleared up those contradictions. Just swept them right away. Folks, if you're enjoying our series on apparent contradictions in the Bible, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. Send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The address again, LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks, as usual, for listening, and thanks, as always, for your continued support. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Molly Ziegler-Hemingway of Christianity Today magazine, along with Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service. Now, he is of, they're both of GetReligion.org. If you've never seen this blog, you really should visit it. It basically keeps an eye on media coverage of religion. They've been doing it for 7 years now. We'll see what they've learned about the media's coverage on religion after this. Pop spirituality teaches you to look inside yourself. True spirituality teaches you to look outside yourself to the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January is titled Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. You can purchase Lutheran Spirituality by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org, Lutheran Spirituality.
Well, I think that's a very good question.
Check out our new YouTube video, Good Question, issuesetc.org, and click support. Good questions, better answers, Issues Etc. Watch the short YouTube video, Good Question, today. Just go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org.
Well, you know, that's a good question.
That's a very good question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
No, that's a good question.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Encouraging pro-life workers.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The North American Mission Board, part of the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest Protestant denomination in America, recently held an important conference for pregnancy support centers. NAMB is affiliated with nearly 300 pregnancy support centers throughout America. The conference, attended by the directors and staff members of nearly 200 centers from 13 states, included workshops and speeches by noted author Henry Blackaby, as well as Richard Land, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and others. For more on this conference, tune in tomorrow.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.